You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
I'm going to be emerging for years. I know. Well, that's the weird thing about having this as a sort of a second career later in life. It's like, I'm still kind of new, but I'm still
hold on
old.
To that. I mean, you know, it's a cliche, but journalism can keep you young. Welcome to Offscript, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Rob Weiner, Kent, the editor-in-chief. I'm here with...
Associate Editor Deep Tran.
And we're happy to have our guest today.
Hi, this is Nicole Saratori. I'm a freelance journalist and theater critic.
Sometimes for us, and for...
The Stage.
Exeunt, is that pronounced correctly?
Sure.
The Stage. And your blog, Mildly Bitter's Musings, right?
Yes.
Is that right? Yes.
Yeah, and The Village Voice.
Oh, and The Village Voice. I'm sorry, yes.
That's okay.
You joined the establishment. No, that's good.
One so publication at a time.
We're going to talk about a couple just sort of fun topics. One is a report last week in the Daily Beast that Tony Kushner, author of Angels in America, is apparently working on a play in which Trump is a character, Donald Trump, our current president. And then we're going to talk about another esteemed playwright, David Mamet, and his aversion to talkbacks. We meant to talk about that last week with Helen Shaw, but we got into so much about criticism, we didn't get to talk about talkbacks. So, and then we have an interview I did last month with Chris Acebo, who's an associate artistic director at Oregon Shakespeare Festival and a wonderful scene designer who I've known for many, many years, going back to my days in Los Angeles with the Cornerstone. And he's a interesting guy, and I'm really, even though I've known him this long, I've never had a chance to sit down and talk to him about design, about Oregon Shakespeare Festival, about the Latino playwriting initiative he started at Oregon Shakespeare. So that's a great interview from Portland and Oregon, which we'll segue to after our chat. So why don't we dive in? It's interesting that Tony Kushner will talk about plays that he's working on. Some writers don't have self regulating ban against talking about what they're working on, but he doesn't seem to mind talking about that.
I don't even know how did that become part of the conversation.
It was interesting. It was a very long piece in Daily Beast, which was like biographical. It was all about Angels near the end, but the first part was, I guess, he was called to talk about Angels, and it came up because you can't talk with Tony Kushner without current politics coming up, right?
Right, right. It's like, what are you working on? Oh, I'm working on a play about Donald Trump, and then that is the lead.
Did you get a sense
that article in New York
from
Times
what this
article.
Play might be like, Nicole, or what kind of play it's going to be? Or
I mean, he was very thin on the details, but he was saying it's being set before the actual election in the sort of years leading up to it, where Trump will be a figure within it. And I don't know. I think that's the sort of how we got here question.
Okay.
Is what at least what you know? What about the few facts that we have seems intriguing to me about the concept that it's not going to be the, you know, Trump biography play.
Right.
It's about, I'm going to guess, it's about America.
really? It's interesting.
But it's not going to be angels in America.
No.
It's like demons or what, Republicans.
Could it be a sequel? I mean, many of the characters survived. Angels, maybe it could be a sequel.
I don't know anyway, if that's the direction.
It's all speculation. I think what we're interested in is whether this person can be characterized on stage. I mean, there's been a lot of stories about how comedians. I think Keegan-Michael Key had a great. He's like, you can't top what he does. It's like, oh, what if he? Oh, he did it. You know, you can't satirize someone who's self-satire. But this is a different.
There's no
thing.
Subtext to the,
right. To
it's all out there.
To portray him. Dramatically is another.
Well, Mike Daisy did it, but it was about like the life of Donald Trump and how he developed mentally as a person.
That's
with
true.
Inspiration from Rory Cohn, who is a character in Angels in America, and also about like why Trump holds appeal for a lot of people.
That
which I don't actually think is accurate anymore, but that's another topic.
I mean, I know there was a lot of sort of fear about this project and people not really wanting to have this conversation or not really interested in this as an idea. And I guess for me, the comforting takeaway I have is how long it takes Tony Kushner to write.
Yeah.
And that by the time that this will be finished, we will be in what we hope is a period of emotional recovery. So there will be perspective at that time.
Right, that's
true. If we still have a republic by the time Tony Kushner finishes writing this play. It's more about you and I were talking about on Twitter, Nicole, about what, like, it's so difficult to, like, write a political analysis of, like, why we're in the state we are today when we are still in it.
Yeah. We're a little pressed up against the glass, and you have no distance, you have no perspective. But I believe there will be time by the time this piece comes to life.
Yeah, I feel like that's why I hate reading all of the analysis from pundits about, like, why Hillary lost the election, how she failed, and what white rural America wants, because it's always about white rural America. And it's like none of it holds up, and none of it makes any sense when you really examine it from the perspective of, like, everyone who lives in this country.
I mean, we can't help but just try to make sense of what's going on while we're in it. And then it's funny. I listen to a lot of political podcasts and read a lot. And if I save a story that's a couple of days old, I don't read a story that's a couple of days old anymore because it doesn't seem relevant anymore.
The story changes every day.
So it is interesting. I mean, for better or worse, Donald Trump's life previous to this and then now is a huge text. So you could imagine lots of places you could go with it or you know, like Mike Dazy did. He talked a lot about Donald Trump's father, Fred Trump. And the Roy Cohn connection is the one that people are making the most. Charles McNulty's review of The Angels in America in London really sort of talked about how it felt to him, and we can maybe talk about this since you saw Angels as well, it felt to him like Roy Cohn felt very immediate. It was very much about the dominance politics, that part of it. The things that Donald Trump apparently learned from Roy Cohn were about, you know, sticking to the big lie and not admitting defeat and those kind of things. It's interesting. Charles McNulty said something about how Roy Cohn would be happy to see that his ideology has triumphed. I don't know if ideology is the right word for Roy Cohn, really. It's like...
it's more like political strategy.
It's, yeah, or just his... just. It's a like a,
and how to
a political
build,
id almost, yeah. Like just against its dominance politics, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that sort of unending tenacity of just pushing and pushing and pushing, yeah. and you know, coming out on top, whether you're right or not, it doesn't matter.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly that kind of character fascinates Tony Kushner. I didn't see Intelligent Homosexual's Guide, and I'm not sure if there's not a Roy Cohn figure, if there's a sort of a... that kind of a mess of a person, a villain, in that play. If the father is, the father seems like, from what I've read about it, pretty noble.
He's an ideologue. Like, he's a sort of a true believer. If I remember, I mean, it's funny because I had to go look up when I was thinking about timelines and Tony Kushner, how long ago IHO actually was here in New York. Mm-hmm. Was 2011. I mean, it's 2009 when it was in Minneapolis, and it's only getting published this summer.
Yes. By TCG. Well, see books, look for it.
Tony Kushner does take a very long time to submit his manuscripts.
Right.
But I think, you know, in that father character, I don't remember him being evil in that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, just really sort of holding on to that sort of communist, you know, soul at a time where everything had shifted away from him.
I mean, I guess what one of the things that's most appealing about Angels as a work for me is that, you know, Roy is clearly evil, but there's a lot of delight in the way he's written. Like, clearly, Tony Kushner, he found something in there that was really excited him to write about, whether it was, you know...
the hypocrisy of the way he lived his life. Yeah.
Even having just... but even just the joke with Ethel Rosenberg, him waking up. I mean, that shows you that he was able to think a little bit like Roy Cohn, like, to make a joke like that. You know what I mean? I'm not saying he was able to take on the character and not just write a cardboard... villain, right?
Well, and the father-son dynamic between Roy
between
and Joe,
Joe
is
totally.
Really nice, and that comes out well, I think, in this London production. And what that means, and what that means politically, the political father, you know, and I think that's where we get back to sort of Trump and Cohn and all of that.
Yeah.
True.
Though, because when I heard about the news that we're going to have a Donald Trump play at some point, another one, it made me think about building the wall and how, like, I saw it because I had to, and I didn't actually have a desire to see the Robert Schenken play about
sort of a post-Trump America.
Yeah, post-Trump America and immigration reforms, horrible immigration reforms. and how it made me realize, do I actually want political theater right now when I'm in the, when we're all in this moment where every single aspect of our lives is politicized and it's infiltrating everything? And do I want that in the theater that I'm seeing, or do I want something that has a little bit of a remove where I don't actually see my, like, our present political moment reflected on stage?
Good question.
And I think we're bringing, I think unfortunately, because of the moment we're currently in, we're bringing a lot of the political, our political minds to the theater so that everything we're seeing is getting sort of pushed through that lens, whether we want to or not. I think it's really hard not to sort of, you know, see it in people's reviews of work where you're like, oh, I mean, there isn't a Trumpian figure here. There isn't a Trumpian moment. And yet somehow the critic is feeling a connection to where we are today.
Right. But is there a difference between like a play about Donald Trump versus like Julius Caesar,
oh, yes,
where it's there is that remove so you can think about it without actually having to think about
it? Well, you know, I think it would be interesting, why aren't we dealing with the issues of today that aren't Trump? You know, I mean, you're talking about immigration reform, you're talking about, you know, there are many, many major problems in America that Trump has, you know, thrown a giant magnifying glass on in the way in which we, you know, he's looking at them, the way in which they're getting talked about. I mean, I'm happy to see those plays about those topics, but I don't think I need to see more about him and his ego.
I actually agree.
Right. I mean, this explains a play like Sweat or Skeleton Crew.
Right, right.
Or plays about working folks. I just wanted to just step back for 1 second and look at Kushner's last attempt to be to write a play that about the current moment, and he actually wrote it fairly quickly. Was not a play that it was published by The Nation, actually. It was called Only We Who Guard the Mystery Shall Be Unhappy, and it was imagining Laura Bush as a sort of homebody-esque figure giving a monologue to dead Iraqi children that had died because of her husband, or, and I think also because of the Clinton era sanctions. And Cameron Manheim performed it. I'm trying to remember if I actually saw her do it or if I heard about it. I did see him talk about it. I think I did see her do it. It's a short monologue. And that was, Laura Bush was a figure that he could also imagine his way into more, because he realized that she was a big reader, and her favorite book was The Brothers Karamazov, and the Great Inquisitor scene was her favorite scene, and that's also his, so it kind of this eerie resonance. So he wrote this sort of beautiful, crystalline argument or monologue in which...
Was it ever performed?
Yeah, again, Cameron Manheim did it.
Okay,
again, I don't know if it was ever published or licensed, but again, The Nation published it. It wasn't that long, so it was short enough that The Nation could publish it. I would be interested to see that again. It was mining the sort of moral, like, what is it like to sleep with this man who's you know, doing such bad things in the world. Homebody Kabul was the other one where he wrote this long play about Afghanistan that was scheduled to go up. I don't know if you remember. The week, like in the weeks before 9/11, and I think it went up at New York Theater Workshop, and then all of a sudden, Afghanistan was in the news in a way that he couldn't. And he jokes often that his drag name would be Eerily Prescient, because his plays are often. So it's interesting to see him wanting to like go back and write something which is not prescient, but is about where we are at. In an explicit way, arguably, Angels was that, because he was writing that in the waning years of the Reagan Bush years, and then it debuted and was a hit in the Clinton years, if I recall, right after his election. But it was sort of very recent history, and I saw it again during the Bush administration in a small production somewhere, and it really, that whole scene in the early on with Joe and the Republican operative talking about a permanent Republican majority, like it feels like that play is going to be with us. Maybe we could segue to we should say more about the Trump Kushner thing. Which, by the way, how is it weird? Is it that there's a Kushner character in the Trump saga? Jared Kushner, no relation. Apparently.
It's really triggering on, you know, theater
so
Twitter
levels.
To see all these references to Kushner. And you get excited,
Kushner.
And you're like, oh no, it's the bad one.
It's the other Kushner. The other Kushner. I know. We can segue to David Mamet, and then we can come back and talk about, I think, Angels and your recommendations, right, Nicole? Unless you want to say any more about this, we can segue to David Mamet, who I think one smart take on this is that he hasn't written a play of any interest for so long, and yet he's a subject of conversation because he keeps sort of trolling us with these. There was an article in the was a the Wall Street Journal about how Dickens makes him want to throw up. I mean, that was a fun read. But
it was like two David Mamet things appeared on my feed on like a Saturday night. That was not very kind of my friends.
So, you know, I guess we could sketch out deep. What's his latest trolling of the theater world?
There's a new stipulation in the licensing contracts for his plays.
For all of his plays.
Okay. That says if they have a talkback or any discussion-like event within 2 hours of the performance of the play, there's going to be a $25,000 fine. So, granted, I don't stay at talkbacks. I find them usually not very helpful or illuminating, but I understand people who do. Mm-hmm. And so it seems like he's going up against what the theater is trying to do, which is to promote conversation among other people, among the audience, and saying, no, you can go, no, you theater audience, go home and reflect on what you saw and don't talk about it to anyone within the 2 hours that you saw the play. It's interesting.
Yeah, it's weird. Interesting. I mean, obviously, there's not a lot of love for talkbacks in their various forms, whether it's the playwright's mm-hmm. talkback and the actors coming out and getting peppered with questions and concerns, or it's a sort of more structured one. I think Playwrights Horizons does really good ones where it's actually an extra event that people sign up for. You don't just get stuck in the theater, and they usually have the playwright curate it. The ones for the Christians was especially good.
Yeah, and well, they bring in outside experts too sometimes.
Right. And the public theater, I haven't gone to those, but they have. I mean,
the public forum events.
They sort of let you know in advance, and it's an event in itself. It's not just sort of a tagged on at the end. So there's good ways to do them. It's intriguing to me that a lot of theaters in the country that we cover are talking about engagement and events outside of just the play. And it seems like it's weird. I guess he has the power to do it, but it's weird to sort of say fuck you to all those theaters. Right. Like, you just don't schedule an event around my show.
But also, why are we still doing David Mamet plays? Like, I mean, honestly, like, if this is really your, like, if you're like, oh my goodness, you're getting all up in arms about this talkback, like, why are we doing his plays? Why is he taking up this space? Like, why are we taking up this conversational space about theater too in this moment with David Mamet talk?
Because
the New York Times ran an article about it, so we need to talk.
I know. But, you know, I just feel like I can treat David Mamet like he treats Dickens. Like, you just make me crazy. And, like, I don't need you in my life. I'm good without you.
Yeah, I guess that's true. There was a sort of ritual revival of some of his work on Broadway for a while. There was American Buffalo.
And then there was also his new works produced on Broadway.
Oh, it does. And it's a tryout. You know,
he's one of the few living playwrights who gets produced directly on Broadway, right?
Yeah, and they all fail and he still gets produced. Like, what does that tell you about, you know, privilege?
Well, you know, it's interesting that his last one, whatever that Al Pacino monologue was called
A China Doll.
Right. Yeah, terrible name.
Where Al Pacino didn't remember his lines, and so he had to have his lines
Oh no, but he was talking on Bluetooth. Anyway, it was interesting that, you know, not to be too catty about David Mamet. I mean, I take your point, Nicole, but his next play was at the Atlantic, off Broadway. So The Penitent, which apparently was like a penitence to go see it.
Is he penitent in that play?
No, I don't know. I don't.
Women.
Look, we publish David Mamet's plays at TCG, so which is fine. We can say whatever we want on this podcast. Let's get away from Mamet. The main thing is like talkbacks. Like he's thrown down this gauntlet about talkbacks. I mean, I've got a quote from the Nottish from years ago where she goes, "I hate that shit. I hate talkbacks." is basically she said. And you know, she doesn't like the idea that I just told you what I thought with my play. Why do I have to come out and explain it? But that's one that's the playwright talkback, right?
But I'd also like to know. I mean, do theaters have this track record of these talkbacks leading to some sort of quote engagement that has tangible value to theaters? Because I mean, for me, I'm like, oh, you're doing a talkback. I immediately race out of the theater as fast as humanly possible because I'm not actually interested in the conversation with the audience in that format. I'm happy to have a conversation with an audience of my own, you know, after the show, go have drinks, have a conversation.
Sure.
I think it's
because like theater is trying to make it turn itself into an event, and it's not just an event where you sit down and you watch the thing and then you leave, but theater is like theater is communal, and what institutions are trying to do is like turn the audience into a community and have them talk to each other. I've sat in so many discussions at TCG conferences about like the value of talkbacks and like how do we revolutionize a talkback and do other things. And what I've seen that actually that's been working better than like, you know, me sitting in the audience asking playwrights questions is like having the audience talk to each other.
Yeah.
Or having audiences, you know, have a drink and meet with the actors and talk to the artists directly on a one-on-one basis. And so it's not so much like David Mamet, the whole like banning talkbacks as like a, you know, a talkback between artist and audience with the stage as a buffer, but he's banning any conversation about the work.
Right. Because the obvious answer is to let people have a dinner break, do a matinee of his work, and then come back if you really want to have a conversation about Glengarry Glen Ross or whatever the heck you're doing.
But I guess that's why I sort of feel like my talkback space is Twitter, you know? That's where I have my community. That's where we meet up. That's where we chit-chat. That's where we get into these conversations. That's where I connect to other audience members. And I appreciate that theaters are trying to find their way into that.
They're trying to make Twitter, but, you know, live.
IRL?
Yes, well, exactly.
I tell you, it reminds me of one of my favorite theater spaces of all time. It's still there in some form, but it was called the Evidence Room in Los Angeles. And it was a former bra factory, this warehouse, that they turned into this wonderful theater that had sort of a modular stage and had a bar. And the guy who ran the theater, Bart DeLorenzo, still directing in LA, great director, he basically said, I think he said this many times to me and to others, basically that conversation afterwards was what it was all about for him. Like, basically, you know, he really believed in the theater, but so basically, I put these plays on as an excuse to bring people together and have a drink and talk in the bar. If you can get that kind of energy, that post-show energy, I actually don't know many places in New York that are like that, where I want to stay afterwards and, like, the bar is as good as...
Signature.
59 has a good bar, right?
Yeah. I enjoy Signature because they have a late happy hour at 9 p.m.
Signature is... Yeah, Signature, that space They're is trying, a little bit, yeah. like, on yeah. a much bigger level, what Evidence Room used to have.
I mean, but that's typical of most London theaters and seriously absent in New York theaters. Like, you definitely feel like you're being swept out with the trash of most New York theaters. You're like, okay, go, leave now.
Right.
You know, and so you don't have that lingering desire to be in the physical space. You don't have that connection to the building where you're like, oh, this is one of my favorite places to come and hang out on a Tuesday. It doesn't mean I'm here to see a show.
But if you can somehow get that energy into a talkback, one of the more formal ones, I've seldom seen that. Although I will say... It's more anecdotal. I haven't been at these theaters, at these particular plays. There's some people say certain plays, people stay longer.
Just linger.
And they have to, I think Joy Meads talked about Appropriate at the Taper. Mm-hmm. She had audiences that they had to basically get out because they just wanted to keep talking. They kept talking on the plaza at the Music Center, just kept talking and talking.
Right. It's like when the play is about like a gnarly topic that you don't know how to have a conversation about, and then the play facilitates
can help have that conversation. Yeah. I don't know
David
why you want
Mammoth
to stop
plays
that.
Do that because his play, like Oli.
Some of them do. Yeah.
I mean, Oleano is like a pretty misogynist, like rapey kind of violent kind of play. And I feel like you would want to talk about that play with some people after you've seen it.
I mean, the two productions I've seen of it, one was really good. One was terrible. I don't know if I want to talk about it. You know, it's like that. I think Race is one where the audience is actually at that play, which is not a good play. But was better than some of his other bad plays. That was one where he wanted to start a conversation, and the audience actually felt. I felt in that audience it was a mixed race audience, and Broadway. They were eager to see this play, and they were eager to take in what was saying. And I felt like that they could have had a great talkback after that play. Again, even as meretricious as it was, and like sort of, you know, I don't think it was made a good argument, but.
Really?
It was still kind of
Straight
interesting.
White David Mamet cannot write a play about race.
Well, he could conceivably. Maybe not call it race, you know, I think as a friend of mine said.
All I know is, like, the best talkback experience I ever had was, like, at the end of Taylor Mack's Here. And it wasn't because anyone said anything really profound, though there were some really, you know, kind of misogynistic questions. And then Taylor answered them, you know, with dignity. But you could tell that Judy was judging the audience a little bit for the quality of the questions. But all I know is, like, afterwards, like, I hung back and talked to Judy, and I got to have dinner with Judy. So that was a very valuable...
Well, you had your personal talk back.
Valuable experience for me.
I mean, at bottom, the idea of talking back is like a good one, right? We want audiences to have it should be a two-way street, right? In some ways, but it's true. It's what kind of spaces you create for it. This institutional sort of formal thing can't be sort of stultifying.
I do like the idea of, you know, small breakout groups, you know, especially if there is a topic worth raising audience member to audience member and, right. you know, sort of wrestling with. Because I think, again, people care, like, they're at the theater, they're coming to live events, mm-hmm. they've paid their money, they've made the effort to leave their house and get off their sofa and turn off the Netflix. And so, you know, how do you capture those people and that energy? But,
right.
I mean, most of the time you're posing questions that I'm completely uninterested in
participating. But they always say, and they should ban the quit. Like, this is more of a comment than a question. But, you know, I will tell you, I was at a talk back at this in Portland, the Portland conference, Teatro Sombra, El Sombra, I don't have the exact name, a Mexican theater who did a play. What was that play called? Do you remember the play?
No, I do not remember the play, okay. Rob, because I did not see the play. I was very sad about that.
And it was about immigration. It was a wonderfully raw, interesting play, which we should look up the name of. And at that one, there were people who are not traditional theater audiences, and their understanding of the talkback was that they would get up and respond, and like they would have voices that you don't normally hear. And I mean, that was interesting because they didn't quote get how to do a talkback, but they were talking back. They stood up to say, "I was really moved by this because." So I don't think we could afford to be too doctrinaire about how they should go. We also should let give people the option to decorously leave,
right.
Before
you know,
they're trapped in a room.
Teatro Linea de Sombra Amarillo.
Amarillo, yeah. Wonderful, wonderful.
And I mean, like, I wouldn't have gotten into the work of Sam Gold had there not been a talk back at Roundabout. And it was a mediate, you know, it was a dramaturg or somebody was interviewing him. And then he spoke about Look Back in Anger. And that for me was like, oh, this is really interesting. Like, this is a whole conversation I was interested in having. And then, of course, it devolved into terrible audience questions.
Yeah. Well, so you were, that's what converted you to Sam Gold, that mm-hmm. particular? Had you just seen something by him?
I'd just seen Look Back in Anger. It was like a matinee.
And you weren't sure about it until you heard him
No, it wasn't I wasn't sure about
okay.
it. But because I had just seen the play,
okay.
and then they announced the director was there to talk about it,
yeah.
I was like, oh, no, I'm definitely staying to hear what this person has
to
say.
Well, cool. Well, so, yeah, I mean, we all have talkback experiences where that one was good, but more normally they're not so good.
Well, I think it's not because they're not good because the artists don't have anything valuable to say. I think, like, the audience members we just don't like the other audience members, allegedly.
We just don't like people is what you're saying.
Yeah.
I still would like to see theater in a bubble. Is that possible? Is that available?
I would like to see theater like in a Netflix
like
kind
of thing.
Like a quiet
car version of theater.
Exactly. Well, I mean, we're journalists, so like, don't we really have like a personal talk back with every artist
well,
that we're interested in?
We have the option.
In?
We have the option, I suppose, more than most folks.
But I think like that's what helps illuminate a lot of these plays for me is when I can talk to the artists. And so I think whatever best facilitates that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think, and I think audiences should, you know, for all the shit we talk about them, they deserve something like that, and it would be great to have good ones. I think, I didn't read Alexis's piece in the Times where she talks to other playwrights about it, but basically they were all pro talkback, more or less, right?
There was a mix. I mean, I think the one major takeaway was Doug Wright meeting his partner at a talkback as someone who asked a question. And I was like, oh, I'd never thought of it as a dating opportunity.
Well, and also,
I'm going to start going to more.
whether or not certain playwrights dislike them, they're sort of against the idea of banning them, right? It's like, don't make me be there, but you can do them.
They're not always there either. Like,
well, no, they're often not there.
Yeah, they're often not there. So it's, if you can just talk to the actors, I feel like that's also, or director, it's very valuable to the audience.
I'm just waiting
too.
For the first theater to defy this. Of course, again, you're right. Like, what David Mamet play is really so worth doing that you want to defy it, but you know. I'd be interested to see if he could enforce this anyway.
I mean, yeah, I'm sure he could. I mean, but that's the thing. Like, if a theater sits down and starts a Twitter conversation, you know, 5 minutes after the end of Race, like, then is that part of this ban?
Count?
I mean, I obviously, as an attorney, I've not seen the language in the contract.
The
I'm not advising
is very
anyone
nebulous.
To.
It's like any conversation afterwards, yeah.
I like me as the artistic director, if I was at a theater, like I can't go out to the bar and like talk to patrons about the play.
Right. If a patron comes and approaches you, it's safe if they ask the question first, but you cannot, you know.
All right. I'm going to give you my hot take, though, is that I feel like there's another act in David Mamet's career yet to come in which he will surprise us and just write good plays
And he'll
again.
Get it. And he'll get that
And he might
act.
Get it. He might.
Unlike
well, he
many
would,
other
you're
playwrights.
Right. You're right. He would. Maybe that's fair. But I feel like he wasn't always this way. He was not always...
But there was also a different moment he was writing to where that like testosterone driven, language driven, just, I don't know, it just had a certain energy to it that feels so out of sync right now. Like, I saw Sam Shepard's Fool for Love. On Broadway. And I was just like, oh, yeah, this has just missed me. Like, this is me and my reaction to that kind of work, where I'm just like, oh, the wave has gone. I understand where that comes from, and I understand where that lived in history. But for me, I'm just kind of, meh.
That's probably true. I guess all I'm saying is that what's sort of interesting is that he still feels engaged. He hasn't, like, checked out. And he's become sort of a grumpy old man, but with just weird...
That Dickens, a giant platform.
Yeah, but a grumpy old man who likes attention.
Right. That Dickens thing was weird, though. Like, I just... Anyway, I just feel
it
like
it was a really weird essay altogether. Like, I like surprises. Trollope, but I hate Dickens.
I feel like there are more surprises
up
his sleeve.
Who's starting that kind of throwdown fight these days? David Mamet.
Right. I mean, I feel like there's more surprises up his sleeve. A play like The Cryptogram is like just a weird, interesting play that doesn't fit the mold you talk about, a macho. That's a strange, interesting play. Like, some people even don't believe he wrote it. Like, there's confusion. Like, or he wrote it under the influence of someone else, or like, I don't know. Like, and I you know,
Rebecca Pidgeon hypnotized him. I mean, who knows?
Anyway, it's true. We're lamenting, like, why are people talking about David Mamet here? We just talked about David Mamet. But, you know, we'll see.
You made me, Rob.
I'm sorry. I think we can go to our conversation with Chris Acebo, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, now. And we'll come back after that with some recommendations. So I'm here with Christopher Acebo, your Associate Artistic Director at Oregon Shakespeare Festival. I've known you for a long time.
Yes.
When you were Cornerstone Artistic...
I was in the ensemble.
You were in ensemble.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember now, Chris, where you were before that, before you Cornerstone.
Before that, I was in graduate school. I was living in San Diego. So I graduated UC San Diego, lived in San Diego for a year, worked with Culture Clash and a few other folks down there.
San Diego Rep there.
San Diego Rep, La Jolla. Just kind of stayed in that community.
Mm-hmm.
And then Luis Alfaro and Diane Rodriguez, who are running LTI, the Latino Theater Initiative, decided to bring a Border Town, which is the show that I designed in San Diego, up to L.A. And right around that time, I got a phone call looking for a costume designer for a show. And so there were these two things that were kind of pointing me back into L.A.,
okay,
which is where I grew up.
I was going to ask. You grew up in L.A. Okay.
I did. I grew up in the San Fernando Valley and thought I would never move back to Los Angeles because I just had such a bad... I don't know. I was just kind of this love-hate relationship with that city. I think as a kid, you just don't... I just didn't connect with it. It was also cement, so there was something about living in a concrete valley that was...
Okay, yeah. So, and what part of San Fernando Valley?
San Fernando, the city of
San Fernando.
Yeah,
okay, yeah.
Yeah. So those two things kind of led me back to Los Angeles, those two jobs. And one of those jobs was designing a Cornerstone production that Bill Rush directed.
Now, I'm remembering now, because we were joking before, you dressed me for one show I was in, the Cornerstone for Year to Go at the Taper.
Yes.
Still have a photo of that costume. It was pretty close to my own style. So you just observed my style and costume.
Yes, that's right.
But were you always someone who designed all different things, or was costumes the main, your way into it, your first?
Well, no. Primarily, my focus was set design.
It was set
when
design.
I was in
okay.
grad school. And Deb Dryden, who was the costume design faculty at the time, kind of encouraged me to think about costume design while I was there. And
okay.
I thought, oh, well, that sounds like an interesting idea. And then it would make me... more hireable in some way. I could do two jobs or one or the other. So actually the costume gig is what brought me into Cornerstone.
Okay.
Working with Bill.
And someone else is doing the sets for that
Lynn
show.
Jeffries
Lynn
Jeffries
Lynn, of course. Yeah,
for Here to Go, and then also for the very first show that I did with Cornerstone, which was a play called A Beverly Hills Musical Morality Tale, which was an adaptation of The Marquis of Keith by Vatican.
Is this the one with Chris as the...
Chris Moore.
Yeah, okay.
The lead.
I couldn't remember the name of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was that was a striking production. It was really striking.
Yeah. So that was my first
Cornerstone. I didn't realize that was your first Cornerstone.
Show. Yeah.
I followed their work faithfully, like a groupie back then. And that was after the Watts.
Yes, that was after
the Watts residency.
That's right.
But then you were in as an associate ensemble member pretty close.
I did that show and then stayed connected with the company and mm-hmm. then a pretty short time after that they invited me to be in the ensemble.
So lot I want to ask you about, but one thing that intrigues me, and I was just talking to Josh Hecht about this because I said I was going to be speaking to you next, is that you help run the Latinx playwrights.
Play project,
mm-hmm. sorry, at Oregon Shakes. It strikes me that in general, you have a lot more agency and artistic say and interest in and leadership than I think we think of designers usually mm-hmm. do. Stereotypically, we think of designers not necessarily just working for hire, but they have their shop and they're about the design.
Right.
And they're not as much about what's on the stage.
Right.
And about developing artists who are other than just, it seems like you have you have a larger vision of the theater.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is, as a designer, there is a mentorship process that you're involved with. If you hire folks there to apprentice with you or to assist you, there's that. So it's kind of micro in that way.
Okay.
But you're right, in terms of having a position of artistic leadership
yeah.
in a large organization where you're not just focused on design, but that I'm also focused on season selection,
yes.
creative team hiring, casting, marketing, mm-hmm. All those things kind of are things that I'm expanded for me as a designer at OSF as part of what I'm doing. So yes, that's, I think it's actually too rare of a situation that
right.
I'm in.
Right.
I think it's, and I don't just think this because I think it's a successful thing for us
right.
as a
right.
model, but I think there's so much value to having someone on the artistic staff that has a connection or a direct relationship with the artistic director in terms of an aesthetic, in terms
right.
of hiring designers, in terms of working with those production staff members, whether
right.
it's the scene shop or the costume shop or the paint shop, and having someone that's in the artistic staff that has an understanding of how those parts of the company work. I think.
Right, right. So it is a lot of leadership over that area, but taking that area seriously as part of the artistic, artistic, menu of, mm-hmm. of the theater. It's not just like, oh, it's over there.
Right.
It's more or less central. I think I've asked Bill about this too, because it is striking about you. I think I asked him about this. I don't think it made it into any stories, but asking about. But he, I think, as I recall, I think he says he really has grown to trust you as somebody, as like a, yeah. a someone, an advisor or an artistic who trusts your taste about theater, not just about what it looks like. Or,
right.
Right. Can you talk about? Is this something that you sort of claim this leadership, or you just found this relationship with Bill? You've always sort of thought about, like, I really care about actually, the artistic direction of this company and of the theater, not just, my materials and my...
Yeah, it's interesting because I think part of that was working with Bill and us having not necessarily a similar approach to plays or even an aesthetic approach to plays. And I think that's part of what's exciting about how we work together,
mm-hmm.
that we balance... ourselves in a great way when we have conversations, when we're talking about specifically as a director and a designer in that relationship.
Right.
And that, as we got to know each other and work with each other, he would also talk to me about casting when we were, this was all, I'm talking about pre-OSF.
Yeah,
when we
sure,
were just
sure.
working as freelance artists,
yeah,
not
yeah.
even at Cornerstone, but working at South Coast Rep.
Okay.
We're going to do this play.
Yeah,
who
yeah.
should we cast? So we were involved in a mini version
of what
we're doing now
yeah, yeah.
In those situations. And
right.
I think that trust, both in terms of, what you were mentioned, not just an aesthetic, but
right.
also, a deeper kind of dramaturgical or a deeper like understanding of how to put a group of people together
yeah,
in
yeah.
terms of a company, like all those things were specific to shows. So it just was an expansion of that kind of thinking when he asked me to be an associate artistic director with him. And I think also it's because we also don't always agree on everything. I think
right.
he values our, our different approaches,
okay.
And is willing to kind of listen to those people that he may not necessarily agree with. But
so I don't want to get you in trouble with you, yeah. with Bill, but no, how would you characterize the, maybe not the differences, but like what kind of yeah. theater you especially respond to or are interested in?
Yeah. In terms of the plays or in terms of
the plays yeah. or even just like the larger context?
I mean, I would like to think that there is a humanity that he brings to a production
uh-huh.
That is balanced by my kind of more metaphoric, emblematic aesthetic.
Okay.
So it's not, I don't necessarily reinforce the humanity in our, okay. in the productions that we do, because right. I know he's going to have
he's
covered
that. Okay.
In terms of how he works with those actors and this, and the detail of that work
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
it, for what I'm bringing to it is let's just continue to expand and, use our imagination or the audience's imagination to fill in all that other stuff that we don't need.
Right.
You know? And so that becomes then balancing, I think, his need to have everything on stage with, how far can we go with having nothing on stage
yeah.
and still create that deep humanity that I know he's going to bring.
Oh, okay. So, you're at a Shakespeare festival now.
Yeah.
But there's only about three or four Shakespeare plays.
Yeah.
You know.
Four or five.
Four or five. Yeah,
three.
Yeah, it depends. I know it's controversial sometimes.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
The two Shakespeare season was,
yes.
was controversial. But, do you resonate with classical work? Have you always resonated with that, or you've always felt like, fine, but let's do something different with it, you know?
Yeah, you know, I think as an early artist, it was all classical work that
yeah.
I kind of did, and because it was more available in terms of college and the works that...
Yeah,
that,
sure.
That, and as I got into graduate school and was at UCSD that had new plays that were being developed through the program and writers, that I started to work on plays at an early stage, and that mm-hmm. became a really exciting place for me to kind of like be a part of either a first production of something and kind of like not have to rely on something that's already lived for hundreds of years
yeah.
and all the baggage that comes with that.
Sure.
There's great value in that too and
yeah.
a great challenge. So the new work is something that I've really gravitated to because it does feel like a new frontier in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah, no, I want to get to the Latinx play project in a second, but specifically, I remember now that when I wrote about OSF a couple of years ago, I spoke to you. I think it was about taking on the new play, you know, new play commissioning. I mean,
yes,
there have been new plays and new writers and writers working at OSF for a while, but not necessarily as a big part of the season and a big part of the commitment. It just seemed like that was going to that added a lot. A lot of work, you know, that's different from doing classical repertoire.
Yes, yes.
And that it, you know, it's not an opposition to repertory, but it creates, you know, some collisions, right? I think you spoke pretty frankly about that. And I wondered, in general, if you feel like it's obviously it's worth it. It's worth working that out
yeah.
and making it work somehow, right?
I think it is. And the thing that what we've come to learn in that the amount of work that it takes to create new work in terms of giving playwrights resources,
right.
Whether it's readings or workshops or any kind of developmental work, we I think what we realized was that the devotion and care to that was so valuable that we were neglecting the classical work to go through similar process.
Oh,
because
right.
even
okay.
if you do an Othello that you've never done with a group of artists
yeah, yeah.
that you've never come, it's like a new play.
Right.
And
right.
that we need the support to actually not necessarily do rewrite, you know, develop the play, but certainly
right.
develop choices around the play
yeah,
and what
yeah.
what the impact of those things are.
Okay.
Especially when one, I think, strong aesthetic at OSF in terms of classical work is actually unfettering it from our from the bias that we might have about it.
Right, right.
Like, what is this Oklahoma about?
Yeah, really? Yeah.
Well, how can it actually go through a metamorphosis that isn't the same Oklahoma you've always seen,
right?
Or isn't the same Richard II that you've seen, or you know what I mean? So
yeah.
Just or the same Tennessee Williams. Like, what is it that we can do? And part of that requires investigation of these plays.
Yeah,
and sometimes it requires. And so one of the things that we're doing, and we've had great support from the Miller Foundation with our Shakespeare, is to actually workshop all of our Shakespeare as we do new work.
Huh? Yeah. It strikes me as a typical Oregon Shakes and Bill Rausch, and of course you deserve credit to it too, approaches. Rather than pull back from this challenge of new plays, let's put the other classical plays with the same rigorous,
yes.
Let's like make them
yes.
harder, right?
Yes.
You know, I'm
yes. I mean, there's like, that. It, and all of this takes time
yeah.
and energy
yeah.
and space and people and resources
yeah.
to, you know, get everybody together. And it takes, like, you know, we have to make sure that the unions are aligned with this new way of thinking
yeah.
and working
yeah.
and so it's yeah, it's all nothing that we do is easy, and none of the choices that we make it any easier.
Right, right. It seems like the bar just keeps getting raised
yeah.
in some ways. I wanted to ask you, let's talk about new plays, and then I'm gonna ask you about some of the plays you designed, including some of the classics you just mentioned. So the Latinx play project.
Yes.
It's a couple years old now?
Yeah, it's actually going on to, well, it's gone through various incarnations, but
okay.
in its current form, it's been like 5 years now.
And it's a weekend or two?
Yeah, it's every other year.
Okay.
Currently, and it is a weekend. We are evolving the program as we've been working on it for the last several years, but it is to introduce new Latino writers to OSF.
Mm-hmm.
And to connect our Latinx artists that are at OSF, so our writers, our directors, dramaturgs, anyone who identifies, to connect with artists that are outside of the Rogue Valley that also identify as Latino. So we bring them in, we bring folks in, we do two play readings, we do a panel discussion, we have some informal cafecitos, and just to have a really fun time networking and connecting around new play and new work. And so it's been pretty extraordinary. We got a generous grant from the Time Warner Foundation to continue that part of the Latinx play project, which
mm-hmm.
is that weekend. But we're also going to start the Latinx Lab, which is bringing in other writers over the course of a few weeks this summer in a mentor and mentee capacity, working with our acting company to develop whatever work they want to develop.
Okay.
So yeah, it's exciting. There's a lot of pieces to it that are that we're exploring. And it was the impulse of Armando Duran, who's a longtime acting
oh, yeah.
company member
okay.
at OSF, who basically credits the Pacific Playwrights, the Hispanic Playwright Project at South Coast
Rep,
and the Latino Theater Initiative at,
okay.
at the Mark Taper Forum, that those were huge touchstones in his career as an actor. Mm. And we have been talking about it for a while, that there are no opportunities in regional theaters to do that kind of work anymore. And
mm.
Especially in a place that's as isolated as Ashland,
right.
Is that there was a place or a space for that to happen. So yeah. that's really kind of one the impulse for it.
So Armando, yeah, it's actually,
yeah.
Armando, of course, I saw him play at Noriega, like a dictator at Theater of Note. I can't remember the name of the play.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I saw him in a bunch of Cornerstone plays as the devil, I think
mm-hmm,
it was.
That's
yeah,
right.
As,
yeah.
And was it Fastino? No, not Fastino. Los Vecinos.
Yeah, Los Fastinos, yeah.
No, Vecinos, I think.
Los Vecinos.
Vecinos, yeah. And then... of course, he's playing Julius Caesar now, is that right?
That's right, this
yeah.
season he's playing Julius Caesar.
So you're obviously on board with it, but it was his sort of impulse.
Yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
And the idea is there's not like an end goal in sight, like these plays, we want them to be produced at Oregon.
Yeah, I mean, that's
that is the goal.
That is
yeah.
the goal.
Yeah, yeah.
We're gonna start to, through the Time Warner Foundation grant, we're going to have more a rigorous development program for the Latino writers that are commissioned by OSF.
Okay.
To go through a whatever development process they see fit.
Right.
And then also, like we mentioned, like I mentioned, bringing in writers that are not currently in our orbit into our thinking. So
how many writers were part of it this year?
So we had two writers.
Two.
Carmen Aguirre, uh-huh. who's a Canadian, Chilean writer. Hmm. A Chilean writer who lives in Canada.
Okay.
Maybe she could identify as Canadian. I'm not quite sure. Actually, not. So she came down. She did a play called The Refugee Hotel, which is amazing. And then Octavio Solis,
sure.
Who lives in the Rogue Valley.
Really? He used to live in the Bay Area, didn't he?
Yeah, he lived in the Bay Area up until a few years ago, and he and his wife purchased a farm in Oregon, and they lived there now.
Oh, I just remember, when you mentioned Armando, I remember El Paso Blue.
Yes.
By Octavio Solis. Was it the old...
Yeah, and
the Black Swan,
which
I gotta say, I still miss that theater.
Yeah.
But, I'm sure people say that. But.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Is it still a rehearsal space?
It's still a space.
Yeah, okay.
We still use it for rehearsal,
yeah,
and we
yeah.
do open mic nights
okay.
and other kind of community
It's good to know the space is still
Yeah, no, it's still viable.
Space.
It's still viable,
yeah.
absolutely.
So I wanted to ask you about, you design about 3 out of the 11 shows a season,
mm-hmm.
give or take. And one of them that you did this season is Beauty and the Beast.
Yes.
I'm just curious about that. I mean, Eric Tucker's work is interesting in itself. But it's on the outdoor Elizabethan stage.
Yes, yes.
And can you tell me a little bit about how this... Did you do the costumes as well? And did you base them on the Disney...
No, I
didn't
do the costumes.
Okay.
I did the very minimal set for
okay.
this production.
Okay.
Anna Kuzmanek is the costume designer
she's
for
great.
The projection. Or,
Chicago-based, right?
Yeah, Chicago-based.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Jen Shriver is a lighting designer.
Okay.
And Erica Chongshuk is a choreographer.
Yeah.
And Eric is directing. And it's, you know, it's, I think, taking Eric's aesthetic... Which is just kind of like exposing the everything,
right?
And creating a really essential production of Beauty and the Beast, and we've been pretty lucky that the Disney has allowed us to do some rethinking on some of the show. So that's been really exciting to kind of. Try new things and
the actual text, or are you talking about the design? Because the design is so much a part of the.
The design is definitely very different.
Okay.
And also, yeah, some of the scenes, and we're not really changing words, but we're changing some action.
Okay.
And we're also changing, moving some songs around.
Okay.
And also.
That sounds fascinating. I mean, this is a year of the two Disney productions. Anyway. I mean, Shakespeare in Love is not a...
Yes, but they own...
People don't think of it as a Disney.
Yeah.
It's not going to be a Disneyland, but they own that one.
Yes,
but,
that's right.
I know the American Revolutions program has been such a success with nationally, by measured that way. It's been
yes.
making a canon of new plays that are getting Pulitzers
Yes.
And Tonys and all that. But is there a sense, we think we talked about this before with Head Over Heels, and whether, and I guess Shakespeare in Love might be this kind of thing too, where it's, the Oregon Shakes could be part of that sort of out of town, enhanced, pre-Broadway kind of thing. Is that in your, are you the right person to ask about that?
No, I mean, I think I may be the right person to ask, but no, actually, we're not a pre-Broadway tryout kind of house.
No.
No, that's not our intent.
Right.
I think in the case of Head Over Heels, you know, we certainly we love Jeff Witte.
Right.
He's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And we loved that show.
Yeah.
And we thought, wow, this is really, really fun.
Yeah.
The potential for it to move on in some way was
right,
there
right,
but
right.
we also knew that we're creating this show for the Elizabethan stage and
yeah,
it's unlike
true.
Anything
that's
that,
true
and so I think for us we were just producing it, and if it you know if all the stars aligned
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
The producer side or
right.
you know obviously the Go-Go's were interested in a commercial run as well, so
right.
you know, but it wasn't certainly the thing that was driving us to make that decision for that show. And then the other one, the same with Shakespeare in Love.
Yeah. It's funny. I think I interviewed Anthony Heald when he was the first person to play Shakespeare at Morgan Chase in Equivocation. And it's like, is this maybe only the second time, I guess? Maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
or maybe the first time his name is in the title of a show
at Morgan Shakespeare, right?
And then I'm really intrigued about Oklahoma. Everyone's talking about, since you brought it up, and there's another estate where you had to talk to them about what you could do with it. I know there's going to be some same-sex couples. Is it going to be updated in any other way, or is that just going to be...
You know, that's a really good question. Bill has had a long relationship with the Rodgers and Hammerstein estate going back to MMC.
That's right. Yeah,
and getting the rights to be able to do Cinderella as part of that.
Right.
And I think that relationship that he's developed with them have given us that opportunity to kind of recast, rethink some of the play, and I think there will be pronoun switching.
Okay,
but no, we're not changing.
Changing the essence of the show.
Yeah, not at all.
Right. You're gonna be designing. That's next season.
I'm not designing.
You're not designing that. Okay.
No.
What else are you designing this season? I'll just ask.
This season?
Yeah, this season.
This season, I did sets and costumes for Luis Alfaro's Mojada.
Oh yeah,
and Medea in Los Angeles.
Right.
And the set for Unison, which is Universe's work and August Wilson's poetry.
Yeah,
and,
I'm looking forward to that.
So both those are my two other shows this season. Yeah.
Okay. It must be. I mean, do you feel like you have a? It's not play, but like you have like this amazing playground that you work with. It's like this three theaters, an amazing shop. We were at Michael Curry's studio this morning, and I thought you were joking when you said this was smaller than yours, but I talked to someone else and said that the place in Talent, Oregon.
Yeah, it's much bigger.
It's a big workshop, and the staff working all the time.
Yeah, we don't have quite the technology.
The technology, sure, as Michael Curry
that
does.
Mr. Curry does, we've got space. And we have really talented craftspeople, and you know, the thing that Michael... said that was so valuable is the longevity of some of the folks that have worked with him, and I think that we share that also at Oregon.
You've had people who've worked there a long
many,
time.
Many, many years, yeah.
I guess what I'm trying to ask you is, is it like a dream job, Chris, in many ways?
It is. I mean, I think I've got the best job in the American theater. I mean, I know a lot of people probably feel that about themselves, that where they're at. But
yeah,
I'm pretty lucky. I mean, I do get to design three plays a year at least at a great theater with great resources, and work with colleagues that I admire and feel that the choices that we're making in this small town in rural Oregon is having an impact in our field, and I get to live in that beautiful place.
And you get to live in one place. You don't have to go
travel
around.
Every once in
a
while I get to do a show outside, and that's always really exciting. And
but it seems like you're at a job you love. It's a great opportunity, but that you're not resting on the laurels, that you and the company there, from what we've talked about, is pushing yourselves to, like, not get into a routine and go, this is the way it's always been done.
Yeah.
You know?
I think there's a huge responsibility when you have a company like the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and with the budget that it has and the impact that it has, to continue to be ambitious in how you're looking at the work that you're creating.
Right. Right.
And not resting on those laurels. I don't want to say the weight of it, because that feels like it's holding you down in some way. It's actually lifting you up to know that you have these resources and that you can use them for making huge improvements. That's a great...
Maybe it's like a mantle, which is a bit like a burden, but it's also this great privilege to carry, So I'm glad we could sit down and talk.
Yeah, me too.
And I hope to the first of many.
Yeah,
conversations.
This is great. Thank you for wanting to chat with me.
Indeed.
Appreciate that.
And we are back with some recommendations. Let's start with our guest, Nicole.
Well, I would definitely recommend Angels in America in London for those who, you know, want to go see it live. I think the rumors are that it's probably coming to New York. So, you know, there will be a chance to see it again. There are screenings through NT Live this summer. The first was last week. This coming Thursday will be part two. And then there will be encore performances for the next couple of months. I did not find it a great filmed theater experience. So,
Tell me more.
If I would say that, you know, oftentimes NT Live, I think, does a really great job of transforming a piece of theater into a piece of film sort of seamlessly in a way that lives between the two mediums respectfully.
Right.
And this, I found it very difficult to watch. I thought the film choices really cut against the grain of the play and the production, and added sort of a tedious pacing to an already very long experience. So,
wow.
And really didn't do justice, I think, to the live performance. So if you happen to see the NT Live and are disappointed by it, I would say still, you know, save your money up and buy a ticket when it comes to Broadway.
Okay. Well, I think we're all looking forward to that.
Right. And because Nicole, we were talking about this before the recording, but you've seen like almost every production of Angels in America in New York. Right?
I mean, I saw the original Broadway production. I saw the first, Millennium Approaches at Signature when it was off Broadway. And then I've went to London to see.
Oh, you skipped Perestroika at Signature?
I walked out and never looked back. Burned
yes.
my ticket, friends.
Wow.
I really, really hated that off-Broadway production, and I will fight anyone who wants to talk
about it. Well, you don't have to fight me. I think I would stop short of hate. I strongly disliked it. I thought it was a real missed opportunity.
I mean, I saw the replacement cast, so I saw very late in the run, just for, you know, factual analysis here, and my friend who's a sort of theatery person but not in the theater, we both sort of look at each other and we're like, why is this like a bad high school production of Angels in America?
Wow.
And we just couldn't
do it. I would not go that far, although I just thought it was a missed opportunity. It was like some great actors not doing – I didn't like it. And I also was not a big fan of the Nichols one, but that's in the movie but I saw the original Broadway production.
Yeah, I couldn't watch the movie.
But I would not begrudge anyone who fell in love with the play – based on those, because that's what we have. You know, you can't go back and see the Broadway one. So, Deep, what do you have?
I'm going to recommend something from Rob's favorite publication, the Clyde Finch Report.
Oh, dear.
Wow, you're really trolling him today.
No, this is what I do like most days at work.
Okay.
So we're used to it.
All
He's
right.
used to it. It's actually their Critical Eye series.
Martha Sketty does?
Yes, Martha Sketty interviews critics.
She did you.
She
as
did
well.
Me.
Yes.
I'm not self-promoting myself.
Okay, all right, that's okay. She did Jose Solis.
And the recent one was Helen Shaw, and it was great because it's basically like a personal look at like why we do what we do, and you know she asked what would you do if you weren't a critic, and like what inspires you, and can anyone do this profession, and like. What's missing and what's good about it. It's great. It's like a very wide-ranging array of thoughts.
So it's like a good talk back with critics.
It is a good talk back.
It's a great talk back. I can't recommend that highly enough myself as well. Helen, who was on our podcast last week, is one of our heroes, and that Q&A is amazing.
Yes.
And you just basically stole my recommendation. I was going to recommend Helen Shaw's review of Hamlet, which I still recommend, 4columns.org. It's the number 4... columns.org. It's kind of hard to find, but it's a wonderful website. And her review is, you know, by far the best that I've read of the new production of Hamlet at the Public. And
the
not
Sam
just
Gold
because
production.
I basically agree with her take on it.
No, it's like a new arts website run by Brian Parks, formerly of The Village Voice.
Yes.
And they pay journalists.
They pay journalists to review film, dance, theater, fine art. It's a mix. It's wonderful. And her writing is very good. But since you stole that recommendation, I will recommend slightly circling back in a way. Isaac Butler and Dan Coyce have a piece in Slate. I don't know if you saw it today. in which they talk about how folks who saw Nathan Lane play Roy Cohn in Angels are saying it's such a great performance. It's such a pity that Nathan Lane never had a great film career, that The Birdcage is all we know him from. And Isaac and Dan push back against this idea that great stage actors, somehow they never got what they deserved by giving all these great stage performances. Nathan Lane is one of our great stage actors. They mentioned Mark Rylance, who's also given some great film performances, but their point is, and it's a good one, is that this idea that film is the ultimate career topper, you know, for a book. It's not a great book unless it's been made into a movie, or they're not a great actor unless they've had the film career they deserve. You know, there are just some actors who are better on stage and they're devoted their career to it, and that to pursue the other thing or be chased by film or TV is sacrificing some plays they could have made, right? And maybe that's okay. And also, Alexis Solosky was on Twitter talking about the economics of that. Like, we should not begrudge people their film and TV money. Is that, by all means, yes. But aesthetically, this idea that somehow Nathan Lane should have, maybe he could have been an amazing film actor back in the day, right? With different kinds of films, or, and maybe he still will. He's in a
producer's movie too, so it's not like he's had doesn't film. Do
his, well, The Birdcage. I mean, he's but he's
and
like
the producers, the movie.
I'm aware of that. Yeah. He's been in a lot of movies.
Yeah,
he's not been in movies, but it's like he'd never had Robin Williams' career. He never had, you know,
Nathan Lane's career on stage. So
exactly. So that's my point. Or Patti LuPone. Like, has she been in many movies? Not really. Do we begrudge her that?
But do we know who... Do non-theater people know who she is? Yes, they do.
I suppose they do. But do they need to? Anyway, it's a great piece in Slate. It's a good argument. It should be made constantly.
How's Nathan Lane, Angels in America?
He's really... I mean, it's funny because I actually am not a huge Nathan Lane fan.
Right.
I always find him a little sort of too big and too much. And so I was a little, hesitant about how he would play in Angels. But he is playing a very grounded, naturalistic Roy Cohn. A very... just sort of like not even... he's not trying to be sneaky.
Uh-huh.
It's all sort of right there on the surface in a way where it's like, yeah, I'm an asshole and you are going to have to watch out for me. And it's really an interesting interpretation. And I think, a really beautiful performance. So, people should go see that and see him.
Yeah, no, it's inspired casting, I think. Not just because you think, oh, Nathan Lane, he's hilarious. He's hilarious, but I think he has deepened as an actor. If you saw Iceman Cometh.
Oh, that Iceman Cometh.
Iceman Cometh.
It's like,
oh, my God.
He still brought the Nathan Lane glad handing to it, but it was like there's a lot more going on there.
There's a depth.
And he really sustained that sort of marathon.
Which was really nice to see, which, you know, it did sort of, I think my hesitation, it was about sort of that caricature of Nathan Lane and what people come to expect and demand of him as a stage performer, and sort of, you know, those actors who lean into the laughter because they get it, and, you know, and I thought his Iceman Cometh was beautiful.
Yeah, and even Front Page, whatever you think of that, I thought it was a masterful performance in an old-fashioned play that, like, he could do. So anyway, can't say enough about him in general, but I can't wait to see him. Maybe he'll come to New York with that.
And I think, you know, the way in which they've staged this particular Angels in America really doesn't play into the comedy as much as maybe perhaps an American production would have.
Right, right.
And where Marianne Elliott's sort of desire to kind of approach it with a more naturalistic eye.
Okay.
So it is really interesting to watch this sort of well-known comic actor, you know, not take those choices and choose a different path.
Right. Interesting. Like Robin Williams in Bengal Tiger, perhaps? Anyway. Not to make that reference. Great. Another great podcast. Nicole, so great to have you here.
My pleasure. Thank you, guys.
This podcast was produced and engineered and edited by Deep Tran.
Yeah. Right? And find us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. Rate and review us. And if you don't like us, don't say anything.
Don't.
Yeah, don't do any of those things.
And the links to what we talked about will be on our show page.